Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 37, and I'm your host, Nick Ortego. One school district is trying meditation in place of detention. Puerto Rico is putting together a plan that could close more than a quarter of its public schools. And where are teachers most likely to get their ideas? Some new data may offer the answer. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, we have the co-founder and executive director of the Ron Clark Academy. Special guest Kim Bearden will be joining us later. She's also going to announce on this show when her new book will be released and what it's all about. Hey, everybody. Nick Ortego here, and I'm joined by teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt and education data expert Russ Davis of School Status. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Russ, have you ordered your Boring Company flamethrower yet?
I have not, because I would like to stay married.
Yeah, right.
I can't spend $500 on a flamethrower.
Lissa doesn't know what we're talking about. Elon Musk, he has this company called The Boring Company, but it's not boring. It's like boring underground. I think he started like maybe a little fundraiser promotional campaign with hats, and the hats sold out like in a day. And then he's like, well, next we're going to do a flamethrower. And typical Elon Musk, everyone thinks he's joking. He's not. Like, they created a website, sold a flamethrower, I think, for how much, Russ? $600?
It's $500.
$500. And they are now sold out.
Why do you need a flame? Like, what would you do with it?
Well, it's from Elon Musk, number one. It's kind of nerd. Oh. Yeah. Well, it's a roofing torch that's mounted on an airsoft rifle. But it's really, it's like there's 1 or 20,000 and they're numbered, and it's Elon Musk. And if you're a fanboy like Nick and I are for Elon Musk, then the Boring Company flamethrower is certainly on my Christmas list this year.
Yeah. It's just funny. He's just like, oh, we'll do a flamethrower. I saw he tweeted this morning, every flamethrower will come with a fire extinguisher.
I can't imagine.
That's probably an attorney got behind on that one.
Well, so. And I did. And then I saw a California legislator was looking to pass a bill to ban the selling of flamethrowers. Wah, wah.
What if it causes like a forest fire?
Well, I mean,
that's what they were saying. It's like a blowtorch,
though. It's like a souped up.
It's got about a foot flame on it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's.
It's not like a World War II.
I just keep thinking of Beavis and Butthead. Fire, fire, fire.
I don't think those guys could have scraped together $500 in defense. So.
Right. Well, Lissa, top that. What do you know in the teacher's lounge?
I mean, much more important things, I'll tell you.
We'll see.
We were recently talking about the negative effects of expulsion and how that can lead to long-term negative effects.
Yeah, episode 35.
Okay.
Right.
And so I wanted to talk about West Baltimore schools. They were recently featured in the news because they're kind of trying a different approach to try to meet the needs of disgruntled students, behavior issues, things like that. Frustration by using meditation. They have a meditation.
I like this.
Yeah.
This is good.
It's a really neat video that I watched, and then I researched a little bit more about it, and actually a lot of schools are using this, but West Baltimore deals with a lot of students that have struggling home lives, mm-hmm. and just they're just I think they're a little stressed out, and it's a little too much for some of them. And so, of course, they act out. They feel misunderstood in the classroom. Maybe another student is unkind to them, or they feel made fun of in some way. And then the way they handle it is not the way that works best in a public setting. And so, instead of sending these children to the principal's office, or, you know, sending them to detention, or slapping them with a form and putting them on a discipline ladder, they are sent to a meditation room that has essential oils, if you don't know what that is.
Yeah, I think I've seen some people on my Instagram feed trying to sell me some.
I use essential oils. Yeah. I'm sure, you know, y'all, you
are,
know what?
Are you about to plug your business?
I'm sorry. I'm going to take a moment here. I do not sell essential oils. No, I don't. But if I can sit here and laugh and make fun of you guys, you nerds, with your flamethrowers and your eclipse glasses, yeah. You know what? Then You can go ahead and make fun of me all you want.
That's how you really feel.
That I deal with aromatherapy and think it works. But anyway, so calming. So some of us more artsy folk and more holistic approach people, if you do burn certain smells like lavender and things like that, it does have a calming effect. It does have a... Basically, it's all about taking the child out of a situation and putting them in a completely different setting.
I completely agree.
So they have music playing. They have padded floors, you know, where they can lay out and do some yoga stretches. There's sometimes a child that's leading a meditation routine. We're telling them to breathe in deeply, hold it.
Do you guys think meditation works? Have y'all ever tried it?
I have used it. I use it when I teach art, which is always a little bit chaotic anyway.
Yeah.
When kids come in from recess, it is problematic. Stuff goes down in recess. You know, somebody left somebody out, or somebody didn't get out on kickball when they were clearly out on second base.
I remember fifth
and
grade.
So the kids come in just mad and loaded for bear. So I would turn the lights off, play low music, and we would do breathing exercises just for everybody to calm down before we started art, and it works.
I remember fifth grade, John Schneider, French Kiss, Kristen Beavers on the playground, and fifth grade.
Are these real people?
Yeah, these are real people.
it was
the most disruptive thing ever to happen in a fifth grade. We needed meditation.
I'm sure you all needed meditation.
Yeah,
have you guys ever heard of the... Nick, you being in news, maybe I've heard of Dan Harris on Good Morning America. You know who I'm talking about?
Yes.
So he had a panic attack live on the air once. And he worked with a meditation teacher, Jeff Warren. Mm-hmm. And they released a book together called 10% Happier. And it's called Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics. And I downloaded the app and read the book. And they're both very good. Talking about meditation, I know that would surprise you both that I occasionally meditate.
No, I think anybody who has a high-stress job should consider it.
It's pretty cool, and the app kind of guides you through that process. But it's good because it's not like – it's like their kind of tagline is clear, simple meditation, no robes, no crystals, which I think Liss is probably on the robes and crystals side.
No, I'm not.
No essential oils. But it's a good meditation thing. So I completely think that anything that is different for you know, for children and things like that, I have no problem with it working. You know, as long as it's not the only thing we do.
Yeah.
You know, if it's a supplement to keep kids from getting into that loop and even getting into the prison pipeline that we talked about two episodes ago.
Right.
I think it's interesting.
And I know that some teachers may be listening and thinking, well, everybody's going to be trying to go in there and smell lavender and roll around
mind.
On the floor.
I mean, can I get in trouble with yoga, please?
You probably were just too scared to say that out loud because you knew I would jump on you. But yes, anytime you offer an alternative way of reaching children, everybody's going to be curious about it. So you know what you can do? You can offer that in your classroom as part of like I did, where they come in from recess and this is what we do. Mm-hmm. You know, you can offer that to where it's not so much of a, well, that's not fair, they got to go in there.
Yeah.
You know, you can do it too. You can do small amounts of it too, to where, you know, I mean, because even when kids do visit this meditation room and things like that, they still have makeup work that they have to do when they come back. You know, they still were out of the classroom.
Well, I think the meditation thing may be more significant than the flamethrower. So, so well done, Russ. That puts you on the spot because you're up next. What do you know?
So, Nick, I know that we've talked a lot about the crisis in Puerto Rico, maybe too much, but I think that we really can't, you know, pay enough attention to this issue. But just recently, the governor of Puerto Rico released a new fiscal plan that would close 300 of the island's 1,100 schools, so a little over a quarter of the schools. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to save about $300 million by fiscal year 2022. So, you know, there's obviously a big upheaval about closing that many schools. Closing schools is truly the political third rail of politics, right? Everybody's fine with like consolidation and back office, whatever. But whenever you start closing the schools where people went to school, it's really personal and it's a really big deal.
Yeah.
And so essentially what happened is there's been a tremendous population drop that, you know, has affected the island. And so now I think they're just trying to make it work. And this was largely already, it's like, It was like a boulder rolling downhill, right? This was going to happen regardless of Maria or not. But I think now they're using Maria as kind of a useful, you know, lever, basically, to get this to happen.
So if I'm hearing you right, you're basically saying the headline sounds worse than maybe this all really is. This may not be.
Yeah, the headline is plan would close a more than a quarter of Puerto Rico's public schools, which is completely factual. But the truth is that a lot of these schools are probably going to close anyway. And after the hurricane, they've had an even larger population drop because the island's been losing population for years. And their fiscal struggles are pretty well known. I mean, they're very, very heavily in debt. They have lots of bondholders that are kind of at their throats. And so they need to figure out a way to save money in order to pay their bondholders. And I think they're actually in a form of bankruptcy right now as an island. I'm not 100% sure how that works. I think they have to ask Congress's permission to actually declare bankruptcy. But in any case, 78% of students had returned to their schools. So that's a pretty big number of students who did not return to their schools. And, you know, after Hurricane Katrina, we saw this too in the Southeast, that there were just a lot of kids who didn't come back. And there are districts that just never recovered from that. People didn't move back to those districts. They moved to other places, or, you know, they went to Houston and stayed there, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that kind of the same thing has happened. It's a lot of these kids have gone to New York and a lot of these kids have gone to Florida, and that's where they're going to stay.
I mean, just through local news coverage over the past few years around here, I've watched some schools close. We always covered that meeting with the parents and the superintendent, and the parents yelling at the superintendent, you know, we went to this school, the school's closed, this is what we know. But it's when you really hear out the superintendent, it usually makes sense.
It's hard to argue with, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and the teachers are probably pretty silent through all of it, but I bet you they're saying,
they need a job. I mean, they're closing schools.
Probably the best thing for them and for their students, you know, because their students are going to maybe have better resources somewhere else.
I will push back a little bit on this and say, like, if you're in an incredibly rural place, like most of Puerto Rico is, right? You kind of think of San Juan and maybe Dorado Beach and a few other places, but like most of Puerto Rico is pretty rural. It's in the mountains. It's a mountainous region. And these schools are the center of life for a place, you know?
That is sad.
And so it can mean the end of life as a lot of folks know it. And if they're closing these schools, their teachers and janitors and caretakers, and there are lots of people that work at these schools. I think we covered the story, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 episodes ago, where they had just went in and reopened the schools by themselves. Like, we need schools open and we're not waiting on the government to do it. And now it looks like a lot of those places are going to close. So it is very sad, but I do understand, you know, if you've got 10 students or 20 students going to a Little Red Schoolhouse, or not enough to really, because you do require a critical mass of students, right? Mm-hmm. You can't have one kid there and keep this big building open. So, you know, I do understand it, but it means that a lot of kids are going to end up riding a bus further to school than they had previously, which affects quality of life. And it means a lot of communities are going to lose that kind of centered environment.
Certainly a story worth keeping an eye on. I was looking at some studies, and there was a survey done on Education Week. It was all about, where do teachers get their ideas from? So I'm going to throw a couple areas out, Lissa, and you tell me what you think. Do their ideas come from colleagues, teacher-focused websites, social media, research journals, news websites, or professional development?
Okay, well, it depends on the teacher.
Yeah, but so, just let's just say in general, like which one was the highest in your opinion?
Which one do I think they got it?
Don't get all
technical on me. I know, but I'm just saying, like, I'm not going to read a journal, so I would feel like probably, you know, whatever the social media web, whatever.
Okay, well, it was actually professional development was number one.
Wow,
78%. Yeah, wow. So including conferences. So. According
I do agree with that, with conferences, but unfortunately I didn't get to attend a lot of those because they're so expensive to go to, and if your district doesn't pay for it, and I do feel like if you can send your teachers to a conference, they will leave so charged, so excited.
Russ, you go to a lot of conferences. Do you think teachers pay their own way often?
No. I think a lot. I mean, I think some do.
Well, I'm saying in certain places that the only way they can go is to pay their own way because they're not.
I think in some places they do, but in a lot of places they don't. It kind of depends on the conference. But I think also that PD, I think the majority of PD is delivered to the school in person, right?
Like,
I think
agree.
That there's a lot of, you know, professional development that doesn't come from a conference necessarily. But I think that a lot of folks budget their professional development money for federal purposes to go to conferences and things like that.
So yeah, PD was number one. Colleagues, word of mouth was number two, not far behind. Teacher focused websites was number three, like classdismissedpodcast.com. Social media, then research journals and news websites. But I'm going to jump ahead because I'm kind of going way down in the data. But Lissa, you mentioned social media. Teachers with less experience in education who are typically younger turn to social media more often than their more experienced peers. Rates of social media use are relatively high for teachers who have 10 or fewer years experience.
So. Yep. And I think that we'll see that grow and grow, you know, because it's just the way of the world, you know. But I do know that the few times I've been able to attend a workshop or a conference of some sort, even like we had a wonderful one come to our school where they, you know, told us how to take a topic and apply it all the way across the curriculum. And they acted everything out and showed us. I mean, they had all kinds of stuff for us to look through, and it was awesome. Everybody left really charged and excited.
They did say in mid-sized districts, between 2,500 and 10,000 students, word of mouth is huge as well, which was right behind that PD, but and, especially in mid-sized districts.
And honestly, too, I have had teachers that have attended conferences or, you know, they went to get CEU somewhere and they came back and showed me, have you heard about this website? I mean, you could use this in your art class. And I'm like, whoa, like I wouldn't have known about that website. And so I do think, you know, from colleagues and word of mouth, you can learn a lot too because of their experience.
So this was another important takeaway to me. It said 13% of teachers responded that the most important factor when evaluating a new idea is that it is endorsed by their principal or district leadership. So that's really,
how much? What was the percentage?
It was 13%, which isn't that
high. That's pretty low.
Which isn't that high, but it does kind of show the impact there. But the most important factor when deciding whether they're going to use stuff is it evidence-based? Mm-hmm. Which I didn't realize that. I know that's a term I hear our guests use all the time, but apparently that weighs heavily.
It does, and there's nothing worse than implementing something in your classroom that you've put a lot of time behind, a lot of resources, and you get to the end of it, and it just looks so great and everything. And, I mean, you know, your administrator comes in and sees it. Tell me about what you're doing, and it looks great, you know, from all aspects, except for when the administrator talks to you privately and says, you know, where do you see the evidence behind this, that this is going to equal blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I really need you to focus more on this because we have such limited time and resources. Let's put our energy more into this and not this. I like it, but let's just save that for maybe a once a month thing. And so you're like totally deflated.
So 39% say if it's evidence-based, that's the most important factor, when it's just 13%, whether it's the administrator.
Is that the plurality? Like, is that the largest one?
Yes. Evidence-based. Number two is ideas align with my personal experiences with instruction. That's at 30%. And then it's followed up by the leadership.
But, I mean, yeah, you don't want to do something and then turn around and have to undo it because you don't have the administration backing or the evidence that the administration would be able to say, yeah,
right,
that sounds great.
Back yourself up.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, Russ and I actually have a pretty exciting bright idea to share. Lissa, we're sorry you couldn't get in on the interview. I feel bad.
I didn't even get invited.
She couldn't afford to go to the conference.
Y'all didn't pay my way to the conference.
They didn't pay. I didn't. This is true. I didn't pay my way to the conference either. I just took the day and ran up to Jackson, Mississippi. But the keynote speaker at Mecca, which, Russ, do you want to explain what Mecca is, who is designated towards?
Yep. Mecca is the Mississippi Educational Computing Association. It's been around for, gee whiz, probably 20 years. And it essentially is a teacher-focused conference that talks about getting technology into the classroom. And it's really changed. It used to be a pretty highly technical conference for, like, you know, technical nerds. But I can say it's really a great teacher-heavy conference now because it brings people through integrating various pieces of technology into the classroom and new things to try. Kind of what you were saying, Lissa, about having that buy-in from your peers is really important.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really, really neat. It's a great show. And like, vendors go like us, and we show them how to use our software more effectively in the classroom. And occasionally, we were able to record a really cool podcast with someone who was super interesting.
Like, she's a rock star.
She's a great interview, man. Yeah. I don't want to do like a spoiler. The thing that amazed me the most was the fact that she runs this academy. She's a co-founder of the Ron Clark Academy, mm-hmm. but she teaches still.
And so, yeah, we asked her about that specifically, and you'll certainly want to hear what she has to say. But without further ado, we'll jump into the Bright Idea.
Our guest in today's Bright Idea segment is the co-founder and executive director of the Ron Clark Academy in Atlanta, Kim Bearden, created the Ron Clark Academy with her friend and colleague Ron Clark in 2007. And since then, Kim and Ron's creation has received praise from support from people like Oprah Winfrey. In fact, Oprah just last year said, "There's not a better school, organization, or institution in the USA," end quote. Kim's also the author of Crash Course, a book that chronicles the lessons learned in her award-winning career in education. Kim, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You guys have such an interesting story, you and Ron Clark. You guys first met back, I guess, around 2000.
Right.
And you both hit it off. And somewhere in the following years, he suggested that you guys start a school together. He had already had his success in Harlem,
right,
you in the Atlanta area, but he wanted the school in Harlem. It ended up in Atlanta.
Yes.
How'd that conversation go?
Well, he did. He wanted me to move to Harlem, and I have a family, and I had been teaching in Atlanta for 20 years at that time. And so he said, "Please come to Harlem." I said, "You know, I don't want to uproot my entire family on this dream, this vision that we have. That's a lot to ask of my family. Please come to Atlanta." It ended up being a perfect location for us, though, because there's been so much community support. Not that New York wouldn't have, but so much community support, so much corporate support. And we're actually in a really great area logistically for educators to come and visit us for training.
You guys went and found a dilapidated 100-year-old factory.
We did. We looked at over 50 sites all over Atlanta, and we just came upon this one factory, and it was in the second highest rated crime zone area of all of Atlanta. It was just an eyesore in the community, and we got out of the car. The real estate agent said, "This is no place for a school," and we looked at each other, and instantaneously we knew it was the place. We thought, we want to show that there's beauty in everything, and we want to uplift a community as well. That community was really trying to do a lot of things to revive itself, and we thought we could be a part of that.
That was a huge risk to invest in such a part of town and sink that money in there. Where were you in your life at that time? And how much was on the line for you?
Everything was on the line, quite honestly. And, it was one of those things, a lot of people thought I was a little crazy. You know, I was very stable in my career. I'd had a tremendous success in my career. And to just turn around and just walk away and say, "I'm going to start a school with this guy," you know, everybody kind of thought I was a little insane. I was newly remarried, and my husband, thank goodness, he just really believed in the dream and supported me in it. But it took us 3 years. People think it was an overnight thing. But the first 2 years, I was still in the classroom, and I was a principal at another school. And then that last year, I completely quit my job and said, "We're going to do this full time," and worked round the clock to get the doors open. So it was challenging. If I had known how hard it was going to be, I don't know if I would have been brave enough to do it. I mean, I think that sometimes ignorance can be bliss. In this case, it was, because I just thought, this sounds like a great idea. It was challenging, but thank goodness I did it, because it's been my life's work.
You know? And it's been an incredible work. And you fast forward 10 years, and I think it was at your 10-year anniversary last year, Oprah Winfrey, of all people, she came to you. Actually came to y'all's big ceremony. At what point do you feel like you're living this surreal life?
You know, it's interesting. We had this dream for the school. We wanted to be a place where educators would come, that would learn. We wanted to be a place, of course, where we uplifted children and inspired them. We thought we had a good idea we open our doors so educators can come, learn lessons, and take them back to their schools. Honestly, the reality has exceeded the dream, which is a huge blessing. If you would have told me, you know, 11 years ago that 48,000 teachers from around the world would come to this tiny little warehouse, I wouldn't have believed you. So it's been because so many people have come together, though. You know, Ron and I, it was our vision, it was our dream, but we've surrounded ourselves with magnificent people who've poured into us. And it's kind of full circle that Oprah came, because, you know, she highlighted the book of Ron's. That's actually where the initial push for his book came from, that got the funding where we purchased the building. And the same week that Ron and I met, it was the first time we ever met Miss Winfrey, because she was at the Disney American Teacher Awards where we met. So it's kind of beautiful that it's all come full circle in that way.
It's pretty amazing. Your academy is always working to find like the best and the brightest talent. Like, what do you look for whenever, you know, you're interviewing potential teachers to work at the Ron Clark Academy?
Well, of course, they have to be masterful at curriculum and instruction and understand how to be a solid teacher. But I'm also looking for that passion. You know, I'm looking for teachers who love what they do, who pour into their kids, who are about children first. It's interesting. Before teachers are hired to work at our school, one thing they have to do is they have to come and teach a lesson, and we watch them teach. Because we all know you could have every single degree, every single thing on your resume possible, but that doesn't mean you can convey a thought to a child. And so we require them to come and teach. They spend the day with us. We really try to get to know their heart as well as their talent. You know, I had many years ago, I had a very accomplished teacher who had everything on her resume that we would all love to have. And she came and spent the whole day in our school, and she taught a solid lesson, but she was one-on-one with kids all day. And at the end of the day, she couldn't name a single kid in our school. And so I didn't hire her. She was shocked that I didn't hire her. But I realized I felt like she just wanted us to be another bullet on the resume instead of it being about kids. So you have to be about kids, not just my teachers, everybody in my school. You have to be about children to be employed there.
That's pretty impressive. So what is the mix of talent that comes in? Obviously, you guys, I'm sure, get a ton of resumes and things like that. Like, are they from the Atlanta area or are they from all over the country? And then, like, is it folks that have been teaching in traditional public schools or is it charters or is it parochial schools? Or what's the mix of applicants there?
We get applicants from all over. We require that a teacher have 3 years experience simply because that teacher is going to be observed by thousands of teachers. And so we want them to be, you know, grounded already and have already taught before. The more experience than that is even sometimes even better. But they submit videos to us where they answer some questions that we post online. And then from those videos and the resumes, then we weed it down and then we conduct interviews and then we invite people to come in. But the mixture is all different types of teachers. I really like having teachers who have had a public school background because I feel like the majority of teachers who come to us for training have a public school background. And so I feel like that they've walked the walk and they've talked the talk and they understand the challenges and the struggles that public school teachers are faced with every day so that they can help provide support for that. So that's not a non-negotiable, but that is something that's preferable for us. And we are hiring now. I guess I should tell you that. We're always, people say, what position? It's interesting. We look for the person more than we look for the subject area. You know, we've got enough teachers to teach all the subjects we need to teach. I'm just always looking for people who have a talent to share and who have a bright light to spread. And so those people are, you know, the people that we hire.
I know one of the rules for your staff is that you tell them to never make a promise that they can't keep with the students. Why is that? And how'd you learn that?
Oh, that's a huge thing. It's actually a policy of ours. We say, if you work at this school, you do not ever make a promise that you do not keep. A lot of my students, you know, come from really solid homes, but a lot of them do not. About 70% of my students don't have a dad in the home, and a lot of them have experienced a lot of broken promises. And so we want to be a place where we show them how a family should operate. You know, a lot of times in schools we say, oh, we're a family, but I always tell my teachers, if we're going to say we're a family, we best be willing to model what an effective family looks like, because the word family isn't always a positive word for some of our kids. And so part of that is that you know, I have your back. I'm there for you. I believe in you. I'm support you. And I'm going to keep my word. You know, I've had many kids, just like we've all know those kids, you know, the kid that sits and waits for that dad to show up on that Saturday and that dad never does and never does. And it's heartbreak. And so for us, your word is important. If you have an idea of something you want to do, you just have to say, I don't know if this is going to happen or not. I would love for this to happen, but I can't promise it. I mean, you have to be really specific. But then if you say it, you got to make it happen.
Just kind of switching gears for a second. Whenever you do have teachers, obviously no one's perfect. And we do a lot on the kind of educator effectiveness, educator evaluation side. What does that process look like at your academy? Do you guys, you know, obviously it's going to be a little different, I'm sure, than most traditional public or independent schools. But what does that look like at your academy?
Well, there's two things that we do. First of all, there's a lot of coaching that goes on. Even when teachers come to us, there's a lot of things that we kind of call our RCA-isms, the way that, you know, students must stand to speak, the way they have to interact with each other, the way that we question, things like that. They're very specifically requirements of our teachers. And so that part, even if they're a really accomplished teacher, they may not have all those RCA-isms down. And so my director of curriculum and instruction, Ron, we go in and sit a lot in the other teachers' classrooms. They're the most observed teachers in the world. They have to get over that, you know, the anxiety of that.
Fishbowl.
Yeah. But the idea is always that we're not here to criticize. We're here to help you grow. And so there's a lot of that coaching that goes on, and we receive it too. And I think that's what's helpful. They understand is that Ron sits in my class. I sit in his class. We're constantly giving feedback in a positive way. The other thing, though, that we do that is really, I think, really helpful is that we videotape ourselves. And so what we do is we ask the teachers to sit down and write down, if I were to be in my classroom, what would I hope to see? And each one of us, we videotape our class, and you want to make sure you can see all the kids in the class too. Now, the beauty of this is that nobody sees that video but you. It's not for your evaluation or anything like that. And so the teachers that go home at night, I do it too. I sit down with my list of, these are the things I hope are happening. Are they really happening? The better you are, the more you see, you know, but we tell them to look for lots of things. We look for, you know, we scan the room every minute and a half and look to see how many kids are engaged, and we work on our, you know, engagement. We listen for the types of questions we're asking. We watch for the movement, and there's lots of different ways. So you could even take the same video and watch it several times, but each time you're looking for something else specifically. And then we have a second video that we do, but we go to someone whom we look up to, just a peer, and say, would you watch my video and give me some pointers? Like, if I want something to know how to integrate technology more effectively, I'm always going to go to junior Sabrina Bernardin or Camille Jones on my staff because they are the experts at weaving it into lessons. But maybe I want to put more artistry, I'll go to Miss Barnes. Or maybe I'm not even getting along with the kid that Ron is, I'll say, or not, I get along with them, but I'm not reaching a child the way that he is. I'll say, watch this. And when that child does that thing, you know, what am I doing differently than you're doing because you're getting a better response? And so it's just a way for us to constantly self-reflect. So in my role as a principal, when I sit down with these teachers at the end of the year and we talk about growth, it's so much more powerful when they say, I realize I need to do this, instead of me saying, you need to do this. And so there's a lot of ownership about how we do as teachers.
There's no doubt that you guys have affected thousands of students. But is there one specific student and story about that student where you just really watch their lives change for the better that you can share with us?
Oh my goodness, there's so many. We have a lot of incredible students. I guess the one that just popped in my head right now is my student named Ajahnay. Ajahnay is a phenomenal young woman and a brilliant young woman, but she came from a challenging set of circumstances, was raised by her grandmother. When she came to our school, she was a little bit withdrawn. She was brilliant already, but she would read voraciously, but she was the kid who read to the point where she didn't interact with others because she was always reading. She was the most gifted writer I'd ever taught in all of my teaching career. And so she did, when it was time for her to go to high school, she actually got a full ride to a top boarding school in the country, like just incredible school. But she got there and it wasn't for her. And so I started to even question, did we prepare her? Did we do the right things? Because our other kids who had gone on and received these scholarships were successful. She was miserable. And so I flew up to the boarding school. And it was great because she did have people there who cared about her, who had reached out to me and said, she's struggling. She's not doing well. And I remember she came into the room and when she saw me, of course, she cried. And I just held her for a long time and we talked about things and she just was homesick. She just was not a kid who was ready to be in that kind of an environment. And so she said, but everybody's looking up to me. Everybody's counting on me. I'm going to fail them all. And I said, baby, this isn't about everybody else. It's about you. Mm-hmm. So she came back and she went to school online. And it was interesting. Her first teacher online thought that she had plagiarized her paper because no child her age could write like that. And wow. So I had to clear that up for her. But we worked with her as she went to school online. Well, now she is a student at the University of Georgia in the journalism school. She's about to graduate early. And she's a stellar student. And she's actually an author. She's written several books online. And she's killing it. So she's actually making enough money where she could be a full-time author without even, you know, but when she graduates, that's what she's going to do. And so I think that the point of that is that when kids are with us, you won't affect them, but you have to stay connected. We try to stay connected to all of our kids. I tell my kids, even if you haven't talked to me in 6 months, you have my phone number. If you need me, if you are in trouble, if you are scared or you are frightened, I'm always going to be there for you. Family doesn't end in eighth grade. And so there's a lot of kids who they had varying degrees of success while they're with me, but because we stay continued to be a part of their lives, we're able to help them through those ups and downs and to kind of get them to the successful place that they are.
Your book, Crash Course, is a collection of things that you've learned along the way in your career. What's an example of a story from that book that may surprise people who are reading it?
Well, I just think that, you know, children teach us so much about resilience, about love, about forgiveness, about joy. And I think that as we get older, sometimes we become cynical and we forget about the beauty of the purity of children's spirits. And so I think that there's many stories in there that resonate with teachers when they read it. I think one that there just is always that not to give up on any child. I talk in there about a child named Jeremy who I could not reach this child. I pride myself in being able to reach every kid. And the thing was, I had a good relationship with him. He was always very polite. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. But he didn't ever do his work, you know? And so it was very frustrating. You know, he said, no, ma'am, didn't do it. And so it would make me crazy because I'm like, baby, okay, oh, you're being honest, but you're not doing your work. And I could not get him excited about learning. And I could usually do that. And so I pulled him after school one day. And I kept him after class and I just said, Jeremy, what do you love? And he said, ma'am? I said, what do you love? And he said, what do I love? I said, yeah, just tell me one thing you love. And he said, well, I love fishing. I said, okay, that's it. He said, that's it? I said, yep, you can go now. So I was like, oh no, now I got to come up with a lesson about fishing. So I went to the Home Depot on the way home and I got these dowels and I got these magnets. I got these little fishing, these little washers and I got this little notepad of fish and I made all these words and I made these little fishing poles and I did this whole lesson. I spent so much longer on that one lesson than you normally would for right. A child. You can't do that for every single child, but this was one of those times where you're like, I got to do something to go above and beyond. And so the next day when the kids came in, I said, we're going to go on a field trip. We're going to go to the covered play area. And they're like, why? I said, because we're going to go speed fishing. And they're like, what? And so we went down there and I had them all in these different groups and they had to run up and they had to cast this little pretend fishing pole into this baby pool of fish and grab one and pull it out and then go categorize. It was a grammar lesson. It took 15 minutes. It took me an hour to make it. It took 15 minutes to do. So that's not usually a good amount of time to invest in a 15-minute lesson. I'll say that up front. But for him, I said, I got to do something. At the end, the kids were all like, this was the greatest day. I said, well, you should thank Jeremy. It was Jeremy's idea. And he was just beaming. And so after it, he walked to me and goes, that was pretty cool. I said, did you like that? He goes, yeah, it was really cool. Now, I would like to tell you that after that, that he did every single assignment there was ever, but he didn't. But he did do so much more, like the astronomical growth, because he was like, okay, this woman's not going to let up on me. She's going to go above and beyond to show me she cares. You know what? I need to do this just out of respect for her. And so it did transform him. And then by the time, you know, I had him as a sixth grader, and by the time he was done with the eighth grade, he was making all the kinds of grades he needed to be making. So it was a process. It takes time sometimes with kids, but it was a process.
The Academy has impacted a ton of students, and we've kind of gone through that. But also, you guys are super well known for doing PD for teachers and administrators and things like that. What's the most rewarding thing an educator has told you after going through kind of the professional development side of the house?
Well, it's a very beautiful thing to be able to meet so many educators from all over the world. It's quite fascinating. And I just think there's many teachers who have said that it just helped them to see, to look at their class in a different way. We have kids of all different academic backgrounds at our school. About 80% of our kids, their families make $34,000 a year or less. My kids come to me with varying degrees of having had success before. But we have the highest of expectations for our kids, huge expectations. To me, expectations are your outward manifestation of your belief in someone. You know, if you have low expectations, what you're really saying is, well, baby, I don't think you can do that either. And so I think one of the, I feel like is one of the most beautiful comments when teachers will come is they'll say, I never knew. I just never knew I could expect that of my kids. I never knew that I could require that of my kids. And I never realized that having those kind of expectations was actually a way of showing them my love for them and my belief in them. It was great for the November 3rd event that we had when Oprah came, our 10-year anniversary celebration. We actually sent film crews to schools all over the country, and we captured some of their stories. So we'll be releasing some of those videos over time on our Facebook and things, but just where schools have just actually truly transformed the way the climate and culture of their school after having been to our school. And so that's really rewarding.
All right, so let's recap real quick. You are the executive director of the Ron Clark Academy.
Yes.
You're on the speaking circuit, talking to teachers all over the country. Let's see, you have your book, Crash Course, available probably on Amazon.
I have another book coming out August 1st. I should say that. I'm really bad at personal plugs, but I have another book coming out August 1st. It's the working title is Talk to Me, believe it or not, but it's about how we communicate with parents, how we communicate with students, how we communicate with coworkers, really how it's a lot about the way that we interact with each other. Mm-hmm. And so it's these six principles that I delve into in stories to kind of relay them, the messages. But there's even a part at the end where it's kind of got like sample emails that teachers get from parents and what you want to say, but this is how you can say it a different way and still get the message across and how we communicate more effectively. So I'm real excited about that. I just finished writing it, and so it's in production now. It'll be out this August 1st.
So you do all this stuff.
Yeah.
And you teach language arts.
Yes.
At the same time.
That's the number one.
That blew me away, by the
way.
Like, whatever.
Why?
I was doing that.
That's the non-negotiable, actually. That's the non-negotiable. That's the part that can't go away. And I think my staff, they respect that. Honestly, I think that it gives me more respect as a speaker because people know I'm still doing this every day. You know, I'm just not somebody who quit and just travel around. I mean, I'm in the classroom. And my staff, they love that because as school leaders, Ron and I both teach every day, but they know that we have the same challenges, the same struggles, the same kids that we're struggling with, that they're struggling with as well. So I think it gives that credibility, but that's my favorite place. When I'm in that classroom and it's, you know, I'm there with my kids, that's my happy place.
What's a takeaway? So obviously we have folks listening to the podcast. We have folks in the room as well. Like if you could impart, you know, obviously you want to reach as many people as possible, but if you could impart one piece of singular knowledge or something that can, I know it's asking a huge thing to summarize. And what's the one thing that you would want to get across to teachers that are in the United States and abroad? Like what's the one thing that is the most impactful or the thing that you think teachers either don't think about or maybe should know or something that is understated a little bit?
Well, I shared this earlier with the group when I did my keynote, but I think it bears saying again. So as teachers, we get in our little silos and we do our job and we go home at the end of the night and we're exhausted and we wonder, did it really make a difference? Did it matter? That kind of thing. And what I want teachers to understand is that if you affect the life of one child, you do not only affect the life of that child. Indirectly, your influence has an impact upon that child's future spouse, children, extended family members, neighbors, colleagues, business partners, employees, community members, everybody that one day that child will grow up to have an impact upon, indirectly, your life has had an influence upon as well. And then if you multiply that by the number of kids who are sitting in your classroom, and then you multiply that by the number of years you have this profession, truly your life could have an impact upon millions. Mm-hmm. And so you don't always get credit for that, but you still need to rest assured knowing that, and knowing that your life has purpose. On those days when you feel beaten and broken and tired and exhausted and like, why am I killing myself here? You need to know that your life has purpose and it has tremendous significance, because your life has been intricately woven into others and it has an influence upon them.
We talk about that a lot, about how, like, as a software company, we're working with teachers and they're truly changing the trajectory of lives forever.
The best way to follow you, if someone wants to catch up and they aren't already following you, Twitter, Instagram, what do you like?
All of those. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. I am at Kim Bearden everywhere, so I'm very consistent with that. It makes it easy.
Well
so
done. It's hard to pull that off. Yeah,
I know it, really, right? So K-I-M-B as in Barrett, B-E-A-R-D-E-N.
All right, Kim Bearden, are you ready for our pop quiz?
I guess so, yes.
All right, here we go. And just to fill everybody in the room and what we do here, we ask our guests these same 7 questions every show we do. So
oh,
it's
wow.
always fun.
I wish I had cheated and studied. You could have. You know.
All right, here we go. If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
Well, I do understand that I am an English teacher, but here's my rationale for why I'd say reading and writing, because that will give you the power to be able to teach yourself every other subject. So if you can read and you can write, then, you know, if you can read, you can study, you can learn, you could actually teach yourself anything, and all the other subjects, being able to understand them more comes from that.
What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
So at our school, we're very big on teaching discipline, manners, respect, but also those soft skills. How do you give a firm handshake? How do you look someone in the eye? How do you engage in conversation? How do you work a room? We teach that to our kids. It's a big part of our program, so that when my students walk into a room, I don't want anybody to ever have an excuse for not hiring them. I want them to be so prepared that they can dine with kings and queens or CEOs and feel like they belong there.
What does every child deserve?
Every child deserves to be seen.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
Time. There's just not enough time to do all of the mandates that are placed upon us. There's not enough time for all the things that we want to do. You know, that myth of teaching just 9 months, that is crazy. We all work all summer. We work all night. We're grading papers. We're working on the weekends. We're writing lesson plans. There's just not enough time to do all the things. You have teachers who love what they do, but they're just limited in their ability to be able to do it all.
You're our 37th episode, and I think at least over 10 times, time is that answer. So I think a lot of people are on the same page with you there. What's the best gift to give an educator?
Support. Just to believe in them, to let them be seen as well, to let them know that you see when they're doing things well, when they're doing things right. You see, whether it's even just a note or a word of encouragement or a card or something, but just to let them know, hey, this is just to say, I see you. I see the work you're doing.
Which teacher changed your life?
So Mrs. Brown, she was my 7th grade English teacher, and I wanted to walk like her, talk like her, dress like her, smell like her. I wanted to be Mrs. Brown. And she taught me 7th and 8th grade language arts in Wichita Falls, Texas. I just lived there for 3 years, and 2 of those years I was blessed to have her. I tried to find her after I grew up, became a teacher, and she had already passed on. But I just have to believe that somewhere she knows that I think about her every single day. I still have all the notebooks from her class. I have every paper I ever did for her.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Last question, pen or pencil?
Oh, I'm definitely a pencil person.
Kim Bearden, you can find her on Twitter and Instagram at Kim Bearden. And you also have a book coming out in August again, and I'm assuming that'll be available everywhere.
It'll be available everywhere, and I'll be posting about that as we approach the release of that.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks
both.
So much, Kim.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and hit that subscribe button, and we'd also love it if you'd leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismissed. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortigo, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed!